case is United States v. Warda. Mr. Cassar, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Captain Hopkins, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge, members of the court, Judge Johnson, it's a pleasure to meet you. I hope I get to see you many more times over the next coming years. I am Bill Cassara, and along with Captain Armstrong, we represent the appellant in this case, Ashraf Warda. Your Honor, I've asked to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal.
Granted.
Your Honor, the military judge abused his discretion in denying a defense motion to dismiss or abate the proceedings where the unavailable evidence was of such central importance that it was essential to a fair trial. There was no adequate substitute for the unavailable evidence. The unavailable evidence was not the appellant's fault, and the military judge varied from the very specific prescribed remedy under RCM 703. Members of the court, this case actually presents a fairly simple issue, and that issue is, what should this court do when all parties at trial agree that there exists evidence material to the defense that another government agency refuses to turn over, and a military judge issues a subpoena for that evidence, and then the government refuses to compel its, and rather the military judge refuses to compel its production? Fortunately for this court, the answer to this question is laid out plainly in RCM 703F2. RCM 703F2 provides that each party is entitled to the production of evidence which is relevant and necessary. 703F2 governs the unavailable evidence and states, if such evidence is of such central importance to an issue that it is essential to a fair trial, there is no adequate substitute for the evidence, then the military judge shall grant a continuance or shall abate the proceedings unless the availability, which is not a question in this case, is the fault or could have been prevented by the requesting party. Under Simmermacher, this court's seminal case on the issue, RCM 703F2 requires a relief, and this court noted that in Simmermacher that abatement is the remedy only if all three criteria have been met under 703F2.
So, Mr. Cassar, if we may, I'd like to kind of break this down into its component parts. In footnote 4 of the government's brief, it says that, quote, appellant failed to establish by a preponderance of the evidence that any, and it's referring to immigration record, existed. And in your reply brief, you say that, characterize that as being absurd. And I find it difficult to quibble with your characterization. We'll let the government address that in a moment. You point to the fact that it was a foreign national. She came here legally. She was in possession of a green card, and she makes reference in cross-examination to not wanting appellant to get access to the information in that file. So let's assume for a moment that there is, in fact, an A file for. I've got a more narrow question for you.
Yes, sir.
What evidence is there in the record? What evidence was there before the military judge that within that generalized A file, there was actually information about spousal abuse?
Well, I remember an adage from an old boss of mine who once said, we don't know what we don't know. We have not seen the record.
So are you saying the military judge did not have any evidence in front of him?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying in terms of the internal, in other words, if you're asking me specifically what is in that A file, we know one of two things. It either showed that she alleged domestic violence, which means that when she testified, she lied about whether or not she could get access in her green card without the assistance of the appellant. That's choice one, that it showed evidence of domestic violence, and that her testimony was then false. Or, B, it does not show evidence of domestic violence, in which case, that's a prior inconsistent statement that the defense could have used at trial.
So wait a minute. And we'd like you please, though, to address the point I have. What evidence was in front of the military judge? Evidence, not inferences. That, in fact, there was material in that A file having to do with abuse.
The fact that she was still in the country past the expiration of her green card.
But, as the CCA noted, there are a number of reasons why someone could be beyond the expiration of the green card, not the least of which would simply be illegal overstaying. So the burden was on the defense to indicate that there was, in fact, evidence there. Wasn't that burden there?
The burden is on the defense to show that some evidence exists that is relevant to the case. The evidence was not on the defense to show specifically what is in that evidence. I mean, RCM 703F2 specifically talks about evidence that is relevant to the case. It doesn't talk about relevant that is helpful to the defense. It doesn't talk about evidence that is helpful to the government. It simply talks about element that is relevant to the case. Her A file would clearly contain evidence, and that's what the military judge had in front of him, that was relevant to the case.
Okay, let's break that down, though, again. In terms of in the A file, let's assume for a moment, I'm not asking you to concede this point, let's assume for the moment there was nothing in there about the abuse. What evidence in the A file would have, in fact, been of central importance to this case that would have been essential to a fair trial?
Well, if there was no evidence, then that would be a matter of impeachment for the defense to use on cross-examination of the alleged victim. What's important to note...
So, wait a minute. Explain that. What would be the line of impeachment?
You've made an allegation of abuse. However, when you filled out your paperwork for your green card, you didn't claim some abuse. That's relevant. And that's a fairly basic question on cross-examination. But again, Judge, I want to answer your question, but I also want to hone back into the fact that the issue is not whether or not the evidence was helpful to the defense. That's a discovery question. RCM 701 talks about, is there evidence that is relevant? Is there evidence that would be helpful in the preparation of the defense? That's a fairly large umbrella that would include these records, certainly. And I think that the key mistake that the military judge and the Army court make in this case, military judge does an analysis under RCM 701, does not do a 703 F2 analysis. ACCA says he did a 703 F2 analysis, which he did not. Respectfully, Your Honor, if applying the wrong rule is not an abuse of discretion, then nothing is. And the military judge did not apply the correct RCM in his analysis. His findings of fact were erroneous in the sense that he did not go far enough because there was evidence that was introduced on rebuttal that he did not, or not on rebuttal, on reconsideration request, that he did not address in his findings of fact, and he was wrong on the law. The military judge was wrong on the law because this is an issue of unavailable evidence under RCM 703 F2 and not a discovery violation under RCM 701. Excuse me, and therefore the military judge erred in applying the wrong rule. The CCA again concluded that he applied that rule. He did not. The government argues that RCM 702 F2 is the correct framework because MAB's records were unavailable. Therefore, it follows that the military judge erred in not applying RCM 703 F2. Now, Judge, to get back into your question, once it is established that 703 F2 is the correct framework, then the threshold question then is whether the records were unavailable. 703 F4A, governs the procedure for production of evidence, and I think this is the key, one of the two keys in this case. We've discussed one of them. The other one is that under 703, as opposed to 701, the threshold issue is the evidence under the control of the government. The government council cites RCM 701 for the proposition that it was not under the control of the military. Respectfully, that's irrelevant. Under RCM 703 F4A, it was under the control of the government, and therefore 703 F4B governs the procedures for production of evidence that is not under the control of the government. The MAB's records were not within the possession, custody, or control of the military, but they were under the control of the government. So the appellant is entitled to their production, and that's Davis v. Alaska, that is U.S. v. Ritchie, and that is Pennsylvania. I'll get to the other side in a second, Judge. But the Supreme Court has plainly spoken on this issue. And if you look at Justice Blackmun's concurrence in Pennsylvania v. Ritchie, which we cite in our brief, you'll see where he talks about the ability to have the evidence to effectively cross-examine a complaining witness is of the utmost importance under the Sixth Amendment.
But how does that square with the rule in terms of it being of central importance to a fair trial? How are you saying that the evidence here would have been of central importance to this case and essential to a fair trial. Is that the standard?
That is the standard. I think that Justice Blackmun's, you know, and while Pennsylvania v. Ritchie was sort of a, was not a traditional opinion, his concurrence carries great weight because it followed with the majority opinion, which is the ability to effectively cross-examine a complaining witness is at the threshold of the Sixth Amendment of our ability to ensure a fair trial.
But it seems like you are conflating the two. The standard we have to use is of central importance to in the case so that it would be essential to a fair trial. Let's get away from Justice Blackmun's concurring opinion there and say, with this specific evidence, how would this be of central importance for your client to have received a fair trial here in terms of you're referring to, well, if she didn't file something about spousal abuse in that A file, then she could be impeached on that. How is that of central importance here?
Because the rule for court-martial requires a relief when the unavailability, like you said, is essential to a fair trial. The issue in this case, the sole issue in this case, is the alleged victim's motive to fabricate the allegations in order to stay in the U.S. That was the defense in this case. They were unable to cross-examine the alleged victim. They were unable to put on substantive evidence of what was in her immigration files, which, again, would have showed one of two things. Either that she made an allegation of complaint, in which case that would directly contradict her testimony that she didn't know how to do it, or she did make an allegation of abuse, which would be directly relevant to the issue that she was that the allegations were false as a prior inconsistent statement. The government can't have it both ways. The government doesn't get to say, we have this evidence. We agree with you that it exists. We agree with you that it's relevant. But you can't have it, and then we get to say, because you can't have it, you can't prove that your client, you know, was denied a fair trial.
Is it your position that the government is somehow bound by the assertions of trial counsel?
Yes.
Could you expound upon that, please?
Well, fortunately for me, being on this table over here for 30-some-odd years, I get to switch positions once in a while. The government doesn't. I mean, I didn't cite the cases, but there is plenty of case law, both from this case, that the government is bound by, from this court and from the Supreme Court, that the government is bound by its assertions at trial. Now, had they come up and said, you know, that they were, had they certified this issue, for example, they had the opportunity to take this case to TJAG and say, we want you to certify this issue of whether or not the evidence was readily available, whether or not it was in control of the government or the military. They did none of that. So now it is the law of the case.
Counsel, is there, we've got two standards. One is relevant and necessary, which the government's conceded. The other one is central importance to the case. Is there a gap between those two levels?
I would think that if there is a gap, I haven't thought of that question.
Right. I mean, is there evidence that might be, you know, relevant and necessary but is not central to the case?
I don't see how that could happen, Judge. I think, I'm even thinking of parenthetically, if the opposite could be true, could it be of central importance and not relevant and necessary? I don't think either of those can be true. In fact, what the Army Court said was, and I know that we're talking for the purposes of my argument that we're assuming the records exist, but the Army Court said, we infer that the records exist, but the defense didn't prove by a preponderance of the evidence that they exist. I think it's very similar to, it's analogous to your question. I think those two things are distinctive without a difference. As I think that you're, you know, I think that central importance and relevant and necessary. And I think part of that, Judge, and if we go back, and I know that this court did not grant on the discovery part of this, but I think it is analogous. If you look at a discovery question, and the question is it relevant and necessary, has to do with, can it help the defense at some point in their discovery process? So I think if there is a distinction between those two, it's only in terms of whether the relevant and necessary might kick in a little bit earlier during a discovery process, but certainly the evidence in this case, whatever was in her A file that the government has and did not turn over, was of central importance to the defense, either way, whether it claimed abuse or whether it did not claim abuse. Neither, the government says that this was not the sole evidence in the case. And they cite Simmermacher and Manuel. That is not what those cases stand for. Zimmermacher and Manuel do not require the unavailable evidence to be the sole evidence of the crimes. Your Honor, my time is up.
Can I just ask one question?
Absolutely, Judge.
Do we have to take judicial notice that this A file exists?
I think you can take judicial notice. I think that there was enough evidence produced at trial that you're not, I don't think you need to, but I think you certainly can. I mean, there was enough evidence at trial. You know, and I think, again, one of the contradictions, I think, for lack of a better term in this case, is the defense requested an expert. And I know that that's not the issue that we briefed in this case, but the court knows that the defense requested an expert to help them through this morass of immigration cases that Padilla talks about, how immigration is such a, you know, a foreign concept to most defense counsel. And so the government once again gets to say, well, you asked for an expert. We're not going to give you an expert, but now you can't tell us what how an A file works. Well, of course we can't, conclusively, because you didn't provide us with an expert. It's similar to when they say that there were language barriers at trial. Well, you could have put up a translator. The government continued to put up constitutional obstacles to the defense presenting a case and then trying to use it as a shield. And for that reason, the appellant's conviction should be reversed.
You noted, this is a follow-on to Judge Mack's question.
Yes, ma'am.
I was holding off, but you got there. So that early on you noted that there was error on the part of the military judge because he failed to make findings that arose during the reconsideration request, the argument during the reconsideration request. If, in fact, and this goes to judicial notice, if, in fact, the military judge had taken judicial notice of the existence of the A file, would that have cured your alleged error? You know, the fact that he failed to make those findings of fact.
I think it would. So when you ask me, Judge, we'll learn over the years to come that I tend to overthink things. When you ask me, does it cure the error? It certainly cures the error of whether or not we know that the A file exists. It certainly does not cure the error of the failure to produce the A file.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Chief Judge, I'd like to pose a question, and Mr. Casera, you can answer when you come back on for your second part of your presentation.
Yes, sir.
Here on rebuttal. The question is this, and I'm not trying to signal one way or the other how the court might come out or should come out, but let's assume for the sake of my question that we conclude that the main problem here is that the military judge did not make a specific finding on the issue of whether or not the evidence was central or of central importance to the case under 703 F2 specifically. And if that is in fact the case, would that be a failure to, as you've indicated, to comply with the law or use the law? And in other words, military judge would no longer be assumed to know the law.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the error, where do you go from there? Do we conduct a prejudice analysis? And the reason why I ask this specific last question is because under Zimmermacher, as you well know, we didn't really do a prejudice analysis in that case. So is my question and my assumption of what an error would be, is that something that's structural where it demands a rehearing because you simply cannot cure it? Or is something else going on?
Ms. Casera, would you prefer to answer that question?
I'll answer that on rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Are there other questions from the bench?
That's three times that I've been
not
going to
let you
back
sit down
to my
yet.
Seat.
So at least as my understanding of the facts are, and you can tell me if this is wrong, the military judge and trial counsel very diligently pursued these records up to a point when someone at USCIS told them to pound sand. And then they threw up their hands and said, well, what can we do, right? And at that point, it seems like the defense was very willing to accept that the records were just unavailable. And you mentioned that there's no dispute that they were unavailable. But was that necessarily the case? Could not the defense have attempted – to pursue the records at that time or moved the military judge to continue pursuing the records at that time? Or was it a strategic decision to say, yes, these records are unavailable, and let's jump straight to 703 and see if we can make some headway there?
If I understand your question correctly, Judge Hardy, and please, if I don't, correct me. There is nothing more, and I think that it was just this last term, where, and I'll give you the case site in a second, where this court said, in essence, there is no need for a defense counsel to bang their head against the wall and just say, you know, pretty please, no judge, pretty please, you know, double secret probation, whatever you want to call it. There is no requirement for the defense to undertake a futile act, is the exact quote from the case. It would have been futile for the defense to try to do anything. I think what you saw more in this case was not the defense saying, okay, you're right. It was the defense saying, okay, you're not going to grant an abatement. You're not going to dismiss the charges. You're not going to grant a continuance. You're not going to do any of these things. I got to deal with the cards I'm dealt with, and I still got to effectively represent my client as best I can.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Cassara. Yes, you may be seated. Captain Hopkins.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, good morning. My name is Captain Andrew Hopkins. Along with Major Pamela Jones, we represent the United States. This court should affirm appellant's conviction because the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he declined to dismiss or abate the proceedings. This is true for two reasons. Number one, the records appellant sought were not essential to a fair trial, and the military judge provided an adequate substitute to these records. So my remarks this morning, I will assume for the sake of argument that these records existed. I will also assume, to Judge Hardy's last question, that they were not subject to compulsory process, and we're in agreement with the appellant on this point, that we are in 703F2. Given that...
Captain Hopkins, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. The appellant asserts...
That's what we do.
I'm new. I'm trying to learn the rules. The appellant asserts that, in fact, it was of central importance to an issue at the trial because it was the existence of the records became a linchpin in the defense theory of whether the victim fabricated the allegation in order to stay in the United States. And so explain to me then how government views that an issue central to the defense is not of central importance.
Yes, Your Honor. So the language in the rule is essential to an issue, that is of central importance to an issue that is essential to a fair trial. So the issue here is whether or not the victim had a motive to fabricate. That's why appellant wanted these records, and he's explicitly said that that's why he wanted the records at Joint Appendix This was the reason appellant asked for these records, because he said they were necessary for him to argue that the victim had a motive to fabricate. In other words, there's a law that allows her to remain in the country. If she claims status as a victim, she's still in the country. Therefore, these records would show that she is fabricating her allegations to stay in the country. They were not important to make that argument because appellant was still able to make that argument. He didn't need the records to make that argument. What he needed to make that argument was to show the panel that this law existed, that she's still in the country, and then make the connection, and that's precisely what appellant did. And he did
but,
so
but
at great
counsel,
length. Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't defense also have to show that she knew about that law? Because if she didn't know about that law, then how would that further her motive to fabricate? And I mean, I think the appellant's position is we really need to show that she applied to stay in the country because she was a battered spouse to show that she knew about that. The fact that there's a law, if she didn't know about it, it wouldn't really help very much.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, that is sort of goes to what the trial judge and what ACCA observed, that these records could have cut either way. I think that not having the records to show whether she did or did not apply for the status would actually accrue to the benefit of appellant to make the argument. They didn't have to show that she knew. They could raise the possibility and make that connection, again, as they did at great length in their closing argument. And in particular, I would appoint the court to Joint Appendix 335 and 337, which is just one section of appellant's closing argument, where they really walk the panel through their motive to fabricate argument. They didn't need the records to do that. And indeed, if they had the records and the records show that she had applied for status as a victim under the statute, that could have been used as a prior consistent statement by the government that would have not have necessarily supported a motive to fabricate, could have undermined it. And if they had shown that she was under some other authority to remain in the United States, well, then that would have had no bearing on the issue whatsoever.
How would a prior consistent statement undermine the motive to fabricate? I mean, it would be additional evidence that, you know, it would somewhat support her allegations against the appellant, but it wouldn't necessarily say anything about a motive to fabricate.
Yes, your point is well taken. I mean, what I mean to say is that the fact that she was a victim of abuse and had claimed to have been such and received an immigration benefit for that would be unsurprising, given that she's on the stand making the allegation to the accused at the time. So there's no contradiction there. Your point is well taken that it doesn't necessarily go speak directly to the motive to fabricate. The motive to fabricate is there with or without the records. Is our fundamental point here. Given that, we feel that production of the records was not an issue that was of central importance and necessary for a fair trial.
Counsel, can you also address the appellant's point that even if it didn't say anything about the records did not contain anything about abuse, that would also be relevant? So the chief judge asked the question, well, we don't really know that there might be a file, but we don't know in that file whether there's a document that says I'm applying to stay in the country because I'm a, and if the document doesn't exist, is the file still relevant? And I understood appellant to say it was still relevant, even if there wasn't such an allegation.
I think it would be relevant, but of course relevant in 401 terms. I mean, this is a very low threshold. And to answer the court's earlier question about the delta between relevant and necessary and essential to a fair trial, I think there's no way to equate those things. Relevance is a very low standard. Necessary merely means that it's not cumulative and is helpful to the defense. These are very low thresholds.
Well, what then is the remedy? For what is the remedy if the government has evidence that's necessary and relevant but not central, and then they just lose it, right? Just out of gross negligence, they just lose it, because I think that falls in the same category of unavailability. What is the remedy for the appellant at that point?
So I will answer your question. I would note that I do think that there is a difference between evidence being lost or destroyed, which much of the case law surrounding 703F2 and unavailable evidence does speak to that. Is there some sort of fault to be attributed? In this case, we merely have unavailable evidence.
Well, if you really want to get into that, let's get into that. Whose fault is it that the evidence isn't produced?
Well, it depends on who you ask, Your Honor.
I'm asking you.
We would say that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in finding that these were unavailable. He was told by the custodian of the records, the agency, that they were statutorily prohibited from providing them to him. In the briefs that he directed from the parties, he asked them to provide a memorandum of law on this issue of privilege and whether or not there was a privilege attached to these. You know, the government, the trial counsel's position was that there are some case law out of some district courts that...
Is it the government's position today that none of the exceptions to 1367, 8 U.S.C. 1367, would apply here?
Our position today is that the military judge did not abuse his discretion.
Okay, how do you justify that claim?
Did he
discuss the relevant exceptions?
He was briefed on those exceptions.
Did he discuss them?
In his findings, it's correct. He did not specifically address either the exceptions in 1367 or 703F2.
Do you want to walk through the exceptions and explain to me why they don't apply here, or would you rather just concede that they might apply?
They might apply, but the military judge, in making his determination on an abuse of discretion standard, in determining whether an adequate substitute for lost or destroyed evidence is available, a military judge has broad discretion. And what he did in this case is...
Well, he gave up. What he did in this case is he quit, right? He's doing great all the way up. He issues an order to USCIS saying produce these documents, right? We have a criminal trial going on here. We're going to put somebody in jail, right? And USCIS says, what do we care, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think in answering your question, I can address another one of your concerns that you raised earlier. The government...
So by getting back to my point, I haven't heard any explanation from the government that the exceptions to 8 U.S.C. 1367 don't apply. And I think they do. I'll just put my cards on the table, at least one of them. So given that the government has possession of these records that are relevant and necessary in a criminal trial, but the government's just like, nah, so what? It's just law. Ignore it. Right? So what then? So now we have evidence that's necessary and relevant that the government possesses but doesn't feel like producing. Right? And we can get into a hypothetical about what is the government going to do when some appellant gets up and says, well, you know, my bank and cell phone records, my wife takes care of that, and she doesn't give me access to it. So I'm sorry, we can't produce it to you because my wife's got it. Right? The government's never going to stand for that. Right? Here we have the government's got evidence that's necessary and relevant to the case, to a criminal trial where we're going to put somebody in jail. And they just don't feel like producing it. Right? So now what do we do? What is the remedy for this that was done in this case or that would be reasonable to ensure that the appellant's getting due process?
So the remedy that was provided by the military judge at trial was he granted extra leeway during cross-examination. He allowed the appellant to enter into evidence his court order to USCIS. He allowed them to make the connection to the panel and to even make the argument that the victim was actually the roadblock here and that she held the keys to the release of these records, which, again, I don't think is necessarily definitely apparent from the record. Certainly an argument could be made, but in any event, appellant was certainly able to make that argument. And that was the judge's remedy. And that also, incidentally, was the adequate substitute to these records that 703F2 allows for. Again, appellant was able to make his argument about the motive to fabricate theory without these records. He was able to point the finger to the victim as being the roadblock to the panel's ability to look at the records to determine whether she had or had not actually made application for this relief under the statute. So the military judge correctly, we believe, viewed this as an adequate substitute to the records themselves. It's true that perhaps he could have sought other means to continue to compel production of these records, but because he didn't find that they were of central importance necessary for a fair trial, and that there was an adequate substitute, he allowed trial to proceed. I would also note that, again, although the judge did not specifically reference these particular prongs of 703F2, he was briefed on 703F2 and this court has said under U.S. v. Campbell, the fact that he doesn't spell out his reasoning explicitly is not in and of itself reason to find clear error. Unless there are contrary indications, we must assume a military judge properly considered an accused claim consistent with the law. And we think that's what happened here.
On that point, Captain Hopkins, is your position then that by considering the other exceptions under 703, he had already implicitly decided that there was no need for a finding of central importance? In other words, he was deciding implicitly that the records are not of central importance to the defense case, and therefore I'm going to go to these exceptions here, and this is the one or ones I'm going to choose. Is that the government's position?
By exceptions, you mean providing the adequate substitute?
Yes, yes.
Yes, Your Honor. Effectively, we do think that he did perform a 703F2 analysis, even though he didn't explicitly put it in those terms.
Wouldn't you expect the judge to make a finding of whether the evidence is of central importance or not before he or she moved to the next part of the analysis under the rule?
Well, of course, although we have conceded, or we're conceding for the sake of argument that the records existed,
sure.
It should be noted that the military judge, the trial judge, did not find that the appellant had proven by a preponderance that they did exist. So I think it's apparent from the military judge's analysis that these were things which were potentially relevant and necessary. And I will also point out there's been a lot of discussion of the government trial counsel's concession of the relevance and necessity of these records. The appellant cites to Joint Appendix 408 for that proposition. This is a defense counsel's brief, which references...
Well, the CCA says it in the first opening paragraphs of their opinion. Did they... That looks like a finding of fact in the CCA opinion to me. Is that a clearly erroneous finding of fact? Is that what you're arguing now?
It's not that it's clearly erroneous, but I do believe that needs to be placed in context, Your Honor. In Joint Appendix 408, in this defense brief, it talks about the trial counsel's...
Well, is there any caveat in the CCA's opinion, or did they just say it?
They did just say it. And I think it does bear some unpacking, though, because the trial counsel conceded to the potential relevance and necessity of these records. And
well, are you disputing the relevance and necessity of the evidence here?
I think insofar as the records exist, and as we are conceding for the sake of argument that they do, they would be relevant and necessary. That I think is plain. However, in viewing the trial judge's determination of this matter, again, he's starting from the perspective of the defense has failed to meet their burden to show by a preponderance of the evidence that these records existed.
How was the defense exactly supposed to go about doing that? What did the defense fail to do that prevented them from carrying their burden?
Well, so I will offer to the court's consideration what was before the judge. What was the evidence that the victim had applied for these benefits or that had an AFOL, to be more precise?
Like, let's just start with that she had an AFOL.
That she had the AFOL, because this is, after all, what appellant was seeking. And it was not limited to merely application for relief. The evidence was a answer on cross-examination that she had a green card and that she received a green card when she came into the United States. Then later on cross-examination, she refers
to... Well, let's just start with that. She's got a green card, right? If we get in a car accident and I want your DMV records and I know that you have a driver's license, wouldn't that not be enough to assume that the DMV has records about your driving history?
Probably, Your Honor.
I mean, the logic of it astounds me. I don't know what the military judge is doing here. Like, what more, what else, given that USCIS refuses to admit that the records exist, what more is the appellant supposed to do?
Well, again, Your Honor, we're conceding for the sake of argument that the records existed.
Okay.
But we are accounting for the military judge's analysis and findings here and conclusions.
Well, since we're on the topic, if we're going to assume that they exist or that that was a clearly erroneous finding of fact by the military judge, how does that affect one of the requested remedies by the appellant was an adverse instruction to the jury? And the military judge then denies that and says, well, you can't have that because you haven't proved that any of these records existed. And that seems to be the primary basis for denying that request. If that was part of the requested remedy for the unavailable evidence, and that denial was based on an erroneous foul of fact, how does that all factor into this?
I think the denial for the adverse inference instruction was based upon the failure of the parties to stipulate that the victim held the keys to these records. There was a question as to whether or not she could simply request a FOIA and get these records. There was issues as to whether or not a privilege attached to them. So I think the adverse inference instruction was related to that particular issue. And again, I think in that context, it was assumed that there were records
I'm just quoting from the military judge here. The defense did not establish by preponderance of the evidence that the requested records exist.
Yes, Your Honor. And he said that several times. And there was a sense that he was allowing the defense in essence to have their cake and eat it too, by being able to argue the motive to fabricate theory, by being able to argue that the victim was the roadblock to release of these records, and he was allowing them to cross-examine her on all of this. And so this was an abundance of alternatives to the records themselves, which could only benefit the appellant.
I'd like to scope it back just a bit, just to pull out, aperture. The standard in determining whether an abuse of discretion has occurred is the second half of that is that the decision is influenced by an erroneous view of the law. To the extent that the military judge failed to apply RCM 703 analysis in name, you've alluded to, you said that he did it by inference because he appears to have gone through the steps of 703. But to the extent that he did not apply it by name, as it were, as Judge Sparks, I think, said, can we expect him to at least cite the rule? Explain how that is not an erroneous view of the law. He did 701 analysis. Now, he may have talked his way through using the words from 703, but how his failure to apply RCM 703, how is that not an erroneous view of the law?
Well, I don't think that he viewed 703F2. There's no indication that he said that it didn't apply. One would have hoped that he would have explicitly used the language from 703F2, but again, he effectively did when he talked about the materiality of this evidence, how it could have cut either way, and also how he was providing an adequate substitute. And so he arrived at the correct conclusion in his analysis, and the appellant was not prejudiced. And for these reasons, pending any further questions.
May I ask just one last question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you clarify what you mean when you say the government concedes for the purpose of this argument that the records exist? If we start out our opinion saying the government concedes the records exist, is that right? Or are you just sort of saying, look, one of our arguments is they don't exist or they haven't been proved to exist, but if you don't believe that, here's our other argument. I mean, are you conceding that the records exist?
I don't think that the government is in a position to verify that the records exist. The agency that would be the owner of these records declined to do so. The only evidence that these records exist comes from the victim herself, that she had a green card. Is that a preponderance of the evidence that the records exist? We understand that reasonable minds could disagree, but that's precisely what an abuse of discretion is designed to
protect. But didn't it go beyond that? Didn't she reference that she didn't want the information from those files to get into the hands of the appellant? Didn't that, what are we looking for in terms of simply reaching a preponderance of the evidence here that there was an A file for this foreign national who recently came into this country legally, who possessed a green card, and who seems to be referring to the file?
Again, we're assuming that she came into the country legally. We are assuming that she's in the country legally, but there's simply nothing in the record to establish any of that.
Is the question, though, whether that is true, or is the question, was there a preponderance of the evidence indicating that that was true?
Yes, sir. I understand your observation. We simply feel that it was within the military judge's discretion and that it was not clear error for him to take the actions that he did based upon his...
Well, let's go back to Judge Maggs' question. In terms of a concession, is the government conceding or not conceding that there was a preponderance of the evidence that there was an A file for this victim?
The government is not conceding that, Your Honor. And we ask that this court affirm.
Thank you, Captain Hopkins. Ms. Casera, if you would start by responding to the question posed to you from Judge Sparks.
I'm glad Mr. Squires gave me a fresh 5 minutes or I would have had like 3 seconds to talk. So, Judge Sparks, the simple answer to your question is that a prejudice analysis is not required. RCM 703F2 lays out the remedy very clearly for the trial court. And the remedy is, once this court has concluded that it was a matter of central importance, then the remedy is to either grant a continuance until the evidence is produced or to abate the proceedings. By not doing so, because he did not apply 703F2, contrary to the government's assertions, by not doing so, the military judge abused his discretion, and the remedy for this court is to reverse. Does that answer your question,
Judge? Yes, sir, it does.
Thank you, sir.
But I have another question.
Please.
On the issue of a finding of central importance, the government's position seems to be, if I understand it, is that the military judge kind of implicitly made that finding because of how he proceeded afterwards. And so can you speak to that? I mean,
it reminds me of one.
Does the military judge need to specifically make an express, a specific finding on the issue of central importance?
I think he does. I think it reminds me of when I have a discussion with my wife, and she says, well, you didn't say that. And I'm like, well, I was thinking that. I've never won that argument, Judge, and I would submit to you.
I think the military judge did more than that. Come on.
I've never won that argument, and I would submit to you that the government can't win that argument by saying, well, he effectively applied these provisions. We think he applied these provisions. He just didn't say so. Well, no, because the analysis that he did was an amalgam of 703F2 and 701 with, you know, by sort of combining the two of those and saying, well, I'll give you an alternative remedy. That's not what 703F, I mean, if the judge, and it goes right back to the question that you left me with, Judge, if the judge says it's a matter that is a matter of central importance, and if it's a matter of you know, something that is in control of the government, and we'll talk about that in a second, the remedy is to abate the proceedings. There's not an alternative remedy that is available to the government. Now, Judge, the government says that the government can't say whether the records exist. Well, yes, they can.
Well, I would say you missed the last prong, because there is no adequate substitute. So are you saying that what the judge attempted to, well, let me, is it that he did not try to provide an adequate substitute, or are you saying what he did provide was not an adequate substitute?
I'm not saying either of those.
Okay.
Adequate substitute is a remedy under 701. Under 703, the remedy is abatement. Judge, the government continues to say the government can't say that these records existed. The government, as it is referred to in 703F2, not only had the records, but they refused to turn them over to the defense and refused to turn them over to the court in spite of a valid court order. It is literally shocking.
Let me ask you this on that issue. I don't know if this is in the record or not, and if it's not, then forgive me. But my understanding is that there is a way for the government to procure documents from another government agency. Basically, the military is one agency, and some other agency in the government is it. And if you get into a fight with another government agency, there is a way to resolve that dispute.
There absolutely is. And that's in the amicus brief. I think it's in our brief as well, but I know in the amicus brief, I think it's at page 13, where amicus walks through the steps, and it goes to Judge Hardy's question about the exceptions to the rule, and one of them being when the government is using them in a law enforcement mode. And gosh, if this isn't a law enforcement mode, I don't know what is. But there clearly are ways to resolve the conflicts between the two. And I will use Judge Hardy's word that, in our opinion, the trial judge was simply being lazy. While my last comments, Judge, while prejudice is
well,
not,
is it up to the military judge to pursue that? That would seem to be the trial counsel's job. Once requested, and he or she runs into a problem with the government agency, that why would the military judge be the one to seek the resolution of the dispute?
I agree with you completely. The military judge should have only gotten involved upon the trial counsel throwing up his hands and saying, sorry, we can't do this. That's when the military judge should have gotten involved. Mm-hmm. Chief Judge, any further questions?
Please. One last one. So is the military judge's denial of the requested instruction to the jury about the adverse inference, is that fairly within our question presented?
No. I haven't thought that question through thoroughly, Judge.
I don't think the appellant has challenged that ruling.
Well, and again, Judge, it was sort of, you know, we're at the point of where the defense has been beaten down and the government says, well, you can't have a translator, You can't have an immigration law expert. You can't have these records that we possess. So the defense is like, okay, well, if nothing else, we would want this.
Is that relevant to the question of whether or not there was an adequate substitute?
No, because an adequate substitute is not the proper test. The test.
Well, it's one of the prongs of 703. Right?
Okay. I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. No, because it's not an adequate substitute for the unavailable evidence. It's not a substitute for the evidence. I thought I misheard your question, Jack. But it's not a substitute for the evidence. The instruction is part of the 701 analysis, which is the trap that the military judge and ACCA fell into. It is not a part of the analysis under 703.
Well, I mean, if under 703 you don't get to abatement unless there is no adequate substitute, right? Is the failure to provide the instruction why there was no adequate substitute?
When I said 60 seconds ago, Judge, that my question was subject to further thought process on my part, now I understand your question. Yes, I believe it is, because clearly the judge was trying to, and I think in vain, craft adequate substitute, or the defense, rather, was trying to craft some other way out of this rabbit hole that the government was sending them down, and the defense says, okay, well, if nothing else, give us this, and even that was denied.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Cassara.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Ma'am, it was a pleasure to meet you. I look forward to many more. Members of the court, based on that, we ask that you reverse the appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Case is now submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides, and court is adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise. Court is adjourned until further order of the court.